Humility is a little bit like wisdom in the sense that it's a slippery thing to get a hold of. Just the time you think you've got it, you've lost it. It's that old joke, you know, my humility is the virtue of which I'm most proud. And how do you keep it from being manipulative, you know, taking the lowest place so that you'll get to the esteem of others as you get brought higher? You know, you can manipulate these things. Humility is it's a lifelong learning process. My favorite joke about this: a priest comes into the church and he kneels humbly before God and he says, "Lord, I am nothing." A while later, the deacon comes in and he kneels before the Lord and says, "Lord, I am nothing before you." And a while after that, the janitor comes in and says, "Lord, I am nothing." And the deacon walks over to the priest and says, "Look who thinks he's nothing." It's a hard thing to get a hold of. But the more you practice it, the more it just kind of comes naturally. And you learn through life experience. When you study, when you get more educated, the more educated you get, the more you realize how little you know. And the wiser you get in life, the more you realize that you're really a fool. That these are elusive things, that we're talking about transcendence here. We're talking about divine attributes. And since God is infinite and transcends even our imagination and any possibility of getting around God and holding the whole mystery together in one moment, it just can't be done. And so we immerse ourselves in the mystery of it. And we, with starts and stops and sins and virtues, somehow or other, we muck our way through it and we grow in age, wisdom, and grace. And the more we advance, the humbler we become. That second reading from the letter to the Hebrews, I think, draws this whole thing together. Since this is a divine attribute, humans have been approaching the divine from time immemorial. And so we hear about a reference to this ancient occurrence at Mount Sinai at the giving of the law. So Moses is there with the gathered Israelites, and the mountain is rumbling and erupting and smoking and making huge noises, and they see this as God. And so in fear and trembling, they bow down before him, but they are afraid to approach the mountain very closely. And in fact, Moses tells them not to, because this is God, the God to be feared. And even Moses trembles in fear, and they plead with God not to speak to them anymore, which is the rumbling of the mountain, because they just can't take anymore. So the author of the letter to the Hebrews says, we're not in that situation. That was then. But now, because of Christ, we are approaching Mount Zion. That's the mountain that Jerusalem is built on. And so Zion and Jerusalem and the kingdom and all that kind of, you know, it all encompasses that same word. And the heavenly Jerusalem, he says. Now, the heavenly Jerusalem is a New Testament idea. You don't see that in the Old Testament. The heavenly Jerusalem is spoken of in the book of Revelation, for example, where John has this vision of the heavenly Jerusalem coming down out of the sky. And it's perfect. Its dimensions are perfect. Its citizens are perfect. It's the dwelling place of God on earth. It's the absolute joining of heaven and earth as it will be in the realized kingdom, where everybody will be redeemed and there will be no more sadness or death, but only life and only love and only peace. And he says, that's the mountain that you are approaching. And you don't approach in fear and trembling because Christ has given you the invitation to come close. And so in the liturgy, the altar is Mount Sinai, Zion. The altar is the heavenly Jerusalem. We are in a few moments going to partake of the heavenly banquet. This is the joining of heaven and earth. And interestingly, it's an altar of feasting, of joy, of a wedding banquet, the banquet of the Son, of the banquet of the Lamb, wedding feast of the Lamb. So it has all this joy and festivity about it, but it's also still an altar of sacrifice because it's the memory of his sacrificial offering for us on the cross. That this feast of joy comes through humility. It comes through self-offering. It comes through the God who is so filled with perfection and joy and self-confidence that Jesus doesn't need any building up. He doesn't need to play any games about manipulating the esteem of his fellow human beings. He has it all, and so he can give it all. And one of the reasons that we have a hard time giving it all is because we lack that confidence. Because we aren't as filled with love, we aren't as filled with divinity as Jesus was. But we are invited into that. We are invited to share that heavenly banquet. We are invited to share in that divine life. We're invited to take on those divine attributes of the absolute humility that can only come from absolute confidence. And the older we get, the more possible that is. It's not guaranteed. Not everybody who is old is wise. Not everybody who is old gets humble. It's not automatic. You have to immerse yourself in the mystery. You have to eat it and drink it. You have to take on the divinity that is offered to you. Not in fear and trembling, but in intimacy and love. It's so intimate that we not only can touch it, we put it in our mouths. We eat it and we drink it. Divinity. And so it courses through our veins and it becomes us and we become God. We become sharers in the body and blood of Christ sacramentally, but more and more as life goes on, really. And so the prayer over the gifts today asks God that what we do here sacramentally might take place in power. That it might transform our lives into what we celebrate at the altar. And we don't do this out of any sense of pride. We don't do this because this somehow makes us better than the rest of the world. This isn't a competition. This is this simple, honest, humbly coming before God and receiving what God has always planned for us, a share in divine life.